Lecture 17. Yeah.
17 and 18?
Well, 17 and 18. It'll be, the first one will be 17 and then going into 18. Basil is very, very different from Athanasius in a number of respects, certainly in terms of social background. Basil is illustrative of a gentleman or the Christian in the 4th century who comes from upper class. And Basil's background is certainly one of landed aristocracy and is illustrative of the way in which Christianity is beginning now to penetrate significantly into the upper classes. We actually know significant amount about Basil's family background from a number of documents. Basil is the second of a significant number of children, either 9 or 10. It's not clear in terms of the number of daughters. Basil will be is born in 330. He would die in 379. His father is also named Basil, a significant landowner, probably 3 or 4 major farms in Cappadocia. If you take a look again at that map at the beginning of the course pack, you will see something of the area where Cappadocia is. It's in really what is now the heartland of Turkey. And you actually see it right there in what is now the, as I say, the heartland of Turkey below Pontus. And the family of Basil had landowning in Pontus and in Cappadocia, 3 or 4 significant properties. And you can actually also see there the town of Caesarea. Basil's father was a believer, as well as his mother. In fact, Basil then comes from a Christian background. And one of their parents, one of their mothers, and it's not clear whether it's his father's mother or his mother's mother, is known as Macrina the Elder. And she was converted under the preaching of a student of Origen, a man named Gregory Thaumaturgus. And Thaumaturgus in Greek is the phrase, the wonder worker. And his ministry was in Cappadocia and also Armenia, which if you look at the map there, you can actually see Armenia is right next door to Cappadocia. His dates would be late 3rd century. And he actually, there is a document written by him in which he, on the doctrine of the Trinity, in which he clearly enunciates what would become the standard position that Athanasius develops. And that in the late 3rd century, which is another one of the arguments that the position that Athanasius develops is not an innovation at all, but is the standard theological position from the earlier period. Macrina is converted unto him, and then Christianity is passed down in the family. Her husband is martyred, and on the other side, whether she is the paternal or the maternal, the other parents, the other grandparents are also affected by the persecution. This is the great persecution of Diocletian. And their land is, they are arrested, they are not martyred, but their land is seized. And when somebody was executed by the Roman state, all of their land would be taken and forfeit to the state. And so it says something for the ability of Basil to recoup the losses of his family, because she came from aristocracy. They lose everything in the great persecution. But 20 years later or so, when Basil is born, they are again quite wealthy. And the eldest of the children is Macrina the Younger. And what we know about Macrina the Younger, we know primarily through her brother, a younger brother who we'll see in a minute, Gregory Nyssa, who writes the life of his sister, known as the Life of Macrina. And she would die around 380. And then there are a series of other siblings. There is a young man, a brother who dies fairly young, now Cratius. He dies in a hunting accident when he is 18. There are at least four sisters, possibly five. And then there is Gregory of Nyssa, whose dates are roughly 335. So, obviously, these four sisters might be spaced out differently. Otherwise, you've got six children in 5 years, which is, well, it's not impossible. It could be twins, but whatever. There probably might be two sisters after there, but there's four sisters in the family. And then the younger is known as Peter of Sebaste. And it's quite a remarkable family in many, many respects. Of these figures, Basil and Gregory of Nyssa and Peter of Sebaste are among what are called the Cappadocian Fathers. And the other figures in there also includes Gregory, that's Gregory of Nazianzus, and Amphilochius of Iconium, who we looked at briefly in the last hour before lunch. So we know a fair amount about Basil's family, and it's Gregory of Nyssa who relates the story of Macrina, and I'll say a little bit about Macrina in a minute. Of Basil, we know more about Basil than any other early Christian figure except for one, and that is Augustine. And the reason we know that is we have around 350 of his letters, some of which are theologically oriented, masterful theological treatises. Others deal with, quote-unquote, more mundane issues. And so we know an enormous amount about Basil's life, his career, his theological perspectives, and so on. Now, in terms of his training, he would have been initially, as many were in this period, the schools are still, he would have been homeschooled, if I can use that phrase, as many were in this period. The schools in this period are still under the control, to some degree, of pagans. And that transition has not fully taken place. And so he would have been schooled at home. As he reached an age at which his parents felt he could go away to study, he initially goes to Caesarea. And there is a school in Caesarea where he goes as a young, what we would describe today as a young teen. He eventually goes from there to Constantinople. And from Constantinople, eventually to Athens. He is in Athens from roughly 350 to 356. And so when he's about 20 then, he goes to Athens. Athens was still a major center of education. The University of Athens, which basically goes back to some of the philosophical schools, Plato and his academy, Aristotle, Epicurus, those early Greek philosophers, their schools of thought had kind of coalesced, and there was a center for philosophical education, and also training in rhetoric. And Basil would have gone through a philosophical training there, which does help him in terms of some of his theological exposition, but amazingly doesn't shape it in terms of he is not a philosophical theologian. His brother, interestingly enough, Gregory of Nyssa is, although Nyssa did not have the philosophical training that Basil did formally. What he did end up training in was rhetoric. And as I said earlier, quite a large number, a significant number of early Christian leaders were trained as rhetoricians, the ability to be able to formulate in speech an argument, develop it, expound it, etc. And quite a number ended up being rhetoricians who became Christian leaders. In 356, he returns to Caesarea. And according to Gregory of Nyssa, in his Life of Macrina, Nyssa tells us he came back proud of himself, proud of his studies, determined to make a name for himself. He was going to found a school of rhetoric in Caesarea, and but things go very differently. And in the notes that I have there, there is a section on Basil, and then a number of letters, and I'm just hoping that I gave you the letter. There should be a letter, and it doesn't look like I've given it to you. Okay, sorry. There is a letter in which he records, one of his letters in which he records his conversion. He had come back to Caesarea. He was not a believer, had been raised in a Christian home, and he is confronted by Macrina. By this point in time, Macrina has committed herself to Christ. She has gone through a conversion. For her, conversion also entails the embrace of a semi-monastic lifestyle. And there is a figure who is a very important figure who has influenced her in this regard, and that is Eustathius of Sebaste. And Sebaste is, it's not on the map there, but Sebaste is on the border of Cappadocia and Armenia. And Eustathius of Sebaste was a generation older than Basil and his sister. Born probably around 380, he died 300, he dies around 377. And he was a monastic figure, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on him in that regard. I want to look at Basil in that regard, but he was certainly a pioneer of monasticism in Cappadocia and the surrounding areas. And through his influence, Macrina had come to a living faith in Christ, but also embraced a semi-monastic lifestyle within her parents' household. By this time, Basil is dead. Peter of Sebaste is born around 340 to 342. And that's when he's born, not clear about his death. And at the time of his birth, prior to his birth, Basil Sr. dies. And it's Macrina who kind of takes in hand the family and begins to reorganize the family along a kind of household monastery in some respects. It's Macrina who raises Peter. She has a significant influence on Gregory, but she basically raises Peter. It's not clear from Gregory's Life of Macrina why that is. It could be maybe Amelia found it impossible after the death of her husband to manage the household. But Macrina raises Peter, Gregory emphasizes that she refuses to allow Peter to read secular literature. And all she allows him to read are the scriptures. And Gregory compares this particularly with his own brother's experience and his own experience, because he was quite avid for some secular literature in his teens, even though he didn't have the benefit of going away for a university education. Basil comes back then. Macrina has embraced a semi-monastic lifestyle. She confronts Basil with elements, with first of all, his failure to commit his life to Christ, but also his pride and arrogance. And the consequence of this is that he ends up being converted in 356. And so Basil then is converted in 356. And under the advice of Eustathius, he takes a tour of Palestine and Egypt and a number of monastic communities. And in his letters, and we have some very early letters of Basil from this period of time, Basil expresses amazement, quote-unquote, at what he saw among the followers of Antony. It is interesting that while he expresses amazement, he never attempts to reduplicate that, kind of monastic communities, at least the way he saw them in Egypt back in Cappadocia. He will take up a monastic lifestyle. And so his conversion to Christ also is an embrace of a monastic lifestyle. But with a number of differences from Antony. And the differences are very, very critical. First of all, there is an emphasis on spiritual anachoresis. If you remember that, the term we used, the term that speaks of withdrawal. What Basil emphasizes, it is not important. In fact, it's actually very harmful to withdraw from the society of other fellow human beings, which means withdrawing from the society of believers. What needs to be done is a distancing of oneself from the world spiritually. The withdrawal that God calls us to do is an embrace of Christ and of the eternal things, and a withdrawal from the harmful effects of the world, not a geographical withdrawal. It's the spiritual issues that are the problem, not the actual physical locale necessarily that one finds oneself in. And one of the things that he saw, actually, and the reason why he emphasizes this, is that when he went down to Egypt, what he saw was these monks living out in the desert, many of whom he would later describe as refined egoists or egotists. They are filled, basically, with the same problems they had when they left. I mean, the issue is not physical relocation. The issue is the old nature and the old man and battling a sin within. And many of these individuals were consumed by pride and jealousy. Pride in their own achievements, jealousy when they hear of others who appear to be achieving more than them in terms of ascetic feats. And one of the things you can read through his letters, and he will eventually draw up a rule. There is a longer rule and a shorter rule. These are rules for the monastery that he'll establish. And in neither of them is there any emphasis on the sort of ascetic practices that marked Antony's monastic endeavors. In neither of them is there an emphasis on the sort of thing like all-night vigils, fasting, combat with demons. None of that is present at all. And we'll see where the focus lies in a minute. And what Basil saw was that the focus on those things produced one of two things. One, if an individual is able to do those things, he may well damage his health. Basil's health was a delicate one all through his life. As you can see from his dates, he dies fairly young, 330 to 379. Secondly, if a man manages to do those things, what they cater to invariably is pride. And especially then, if he's in an isolated state, it leads to these individuals being proud individuals who are not loving, nor are they exercising that great Christian virtue of humility. In fact, one of Basil's best sermons is a sermon on humility. It's actually Sermon 20 in his corpus of sermons. And it's really an excellent sermon in many, many respects. And it's in that sermon he talks about salvation by justification by faith alone in that particular sermon. So Basil then emphasizes the importance of spiritual anachoresis and not a physical anachoresis. He downplays all of the asceticism in his monastic rules. So he downplays asceticism. What he emphasizes... He emphasizes, in particular, the idea of community. And the passage that grips him is Acts 2:42. If there is a passage that, remember when we looked at Antony, if there was a passage that gripped Antony, it would certainly be Mark 1, 12 to 13. If there is a passage that dominates Basil, it is Acts 2:42 and then Acts 4:32. 2:42 and then Acts 4:32. These are the two key texts for Basil. In Acts 2:42, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. Fear came upon every soul. Many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. All that believed were together and all things in common. And then again, Acts 4:32. The multitude that believed were of one heart, one soul. That's the key phrase for Basil. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. That the idea of when he develops both of these rules and develops a monastic environment, what he's striving to achieve is what he understands to be the experience of the apostolic church in Jerusalem. The experience of a oneness of heart and soul. So there is this emphasis of the idea of community, a oneness of heart and soul. And then, fourthly, what he also emphasizes is small monastic communities. And in Palestine, you have the two extremes. You have Antony modeling an eremitic monasticism, where you've got these men out by themselves. You have, on the other hand, Pachomius with a koinobitic or cenobitic monasticism with communities of 5,000 or 6,000. What Basil emphasizes is communities of maybe 40 to 50 monks. And that probably is the word we could use. Basil does not use that word. And then, finally, and this is probably the most important one, is that monasteries are to be located in urban centers. And the reason for this is that he sees monasticism as a vehicle of spiritual renewal. Now, we would disagree with that. But for Basil, the monastic movement, first of all, has, as it's developed by Antony, there are some elements of that he sees as positive. Number one, he sees it's positive in terms of the emphasis on a complete commitment of heart and soul and life to God in Christ. But there is so much negative from his point of view of the experiment or the experience of Antony and those who follow him. The isolation, the lack of love, the lack of humility. And then what on earth are they doing out in the middle of nowhere? They're not helping anybody out there. Despite what they say, he never comes out explicitly and criticizes them. But this whole way of building community is an implicit critique of everything he had seen. The church in his day is beset by two major problems. One is the infiltration of significant paganism in sectors of the church. There had been a flood tide of individuals who now joined the church because that was now the thing to do, to get ahead in society. The society is now officially, increasingly Christian. 20 years later, it will be legally only Christian. And what Basil sees then, he sees significant numbers coming into the church with a substandard Christian experience and worldview, perspective, and thinking. And therefore, the monastic environment can be a place of spiritual renewal and spiritual vitality. Secondly, Basil is here picking up something from Antony. Antony was certainly a key figure in the defense of a full-blooded Trinitarianism. We saw that. And for Basil, the monastery is a place of being close to the church. It can be a place of refuting Arian heresy and also being then a vehicle for spiritual vitality. The other last point to make about Basil is that for him, the monastery was more than simply a place of prayer or a place of spiritual combat. The monastery was also a place of physical labor. So the monastery as a place of, let's say prayer first, obviously. Prayer, meditation. Basil has an interesting letter, letter 2 in his collection on the whole area of meditation. But also a place of physical labor. The monks would then be involved in growing their own food for the rest of the household. By the way, all that we're describing here becomes the standard monastic model for the West. And Basil's rules are taken over by a man named Benedict of Nursia, who is a 5th century monk in Italy, who basically plagiarizes Basil's rules. 6th century, sorry, he's 500s. And so Benedict, even more in Basil, emphasizes that there would be certain monks in the monastery who would grow the food for the household. So the monasteries become self-sufficient units. And then a place of healing. And Basil will build one of the first, if not the first, hospital in the monastery he'll found in Caesarea. And it was basically initially designed for lepers, where the monks would take care of the lepers. One of the things that, by the way, that had remarkably impacted the pagan world were the Christians' response to physical illness and the Christians' response to natural disaster. And I'll give you three examples. The first one is, you've got this text, in the life of Cyprian, written by Pontius, there is a passage there that describes how Cyprian exhorts the believers during a plague that hit Carthage not to leave the city, but to stay and take care of their sick neighbors, who may be pagans, but not to leave. Dionysius of Alexandria, who we looked at regarding the canon issue, he recounts an occasion in his life where a plague hit Alexandria, and pagans were getting out of the city as fast as they could, but it was the Christians who stayed and took care of their dying relatives. When Julian the Apostate becomes emperor in 361, one of the first things he does is he writes a letter to a major pagan priest in Galatia and tells him it's disgraceful the way our pagan priests and pagan temples carry on. He said the Galileans, Christians, they not only take care of their own sick and their own poor, they take care of our sick and our poor. And we can't even take care of our own sick or our own poor. And he tells the guy, you need to buck up and start taking care of our own poor and our own sick. Otherwise, we'll never re-paganize the empire. And then you have this example of Basil. And it's not surprising that when you have a gospel that, yes, first and foremost speaks of the salvation of the soul and eternal issues, but it speaks from a framework of understanding man being made in the image and likeness of God, that care for the souls of one's neighbors will soon lapse over into caring for them physically, and a care for them in terms of their bodily health. And not surprisingly, you find Basil then creating this institution for works of mercy. And this will become standard in the Middle Ages, where if there are hospitals in the Western world, they're in the monasteries. And then finally, and this is probably the long term, the most important, is that in the monastery there would be a scriptorium. That is a place where books would be copied, but most importantly, the scriptures. Now, I'm critical of monasticism in some of its emphases, but let me show you something, and it is this book. Why do we have this book? Well, we have this book because down through the Middle Ages and in the early, late Roman period, monasteries copied the scriptures. And they preserved the manuscripts. And most of the manuscripts of Holy Scripture ultimately were transmitted through monastic environments. It's very curious. It's not the way you or I probably would have chosen that vehicle. But when barbarism descends upon the Western world and urban culture and literate civilization is completely lost, almost completely lost, the place that preserved it were the monasteries. And in the providence of God, it is the monks who faithfully copied the scriptures and preserved those texts for us. And so this whole monastic experience then, there is another side to it. It's easy to look at it from one vantage point and see in it a misapplication of a number of biblical texts. Basil, in my mind, again, I would never advocate a monastic environment, but Basil, in my mind, comes the closest in redeeming the institution and making it something of a vehicle for spiritual renewal and the passing on of the faith, as well as helping others physically and the preservation of the scriptures.